Gaming on the Frontier.
This is Bruce.
This is Trav.
This is Jonathan.
And this is Carrie again.
Welcome to Gaming on the Frontier, your podcast of finding out we were wrong, but there was reasons.
We're all adults enough here to realize once in a while that we can be wrong.
I don't know about you. I'm never wrong.
I'm rarely wrong.
Jonathan, you just said you want to see the whole world burn, so just...
And am I wrong? Is that a wrong statement?
Well...
Did he say which world he wants to see burn?
Mm-hmm. We're getting back to the old joke that says, you know, define the universe, give three examples. Which actually works when you think about video games. But, you know, that's not our topic tonight. Tonight... Welcome to Gaming on the Frontier. Our topic tonight is computer RPGs and tabletop RPGs. How are they the same? How are they different? We did an earlier episode way back. And for once, I'm not going to tell you to go back and listen to it because the title of it was Why Are Video Games Make Lousy RPGs? What I'm saying now is that I think maybe 10 years later, we should review this and maybe that statement is no longer true.
I do think, my dear friend, with the recent success of the mind-blowingly wonderful Baldur's Gate 3, that, yeah, we need to reassess this.
That's one of the games I have not played yet because I've been too busy playing other games.
Neither. It's on my Steam wish list. It's just sitting there mocking.
Yeah.
I've been playing but real life keeps distracting me and it's like, ugh, stop that.
Yeah, I live vicariously through others in both the roommate and mine and Carrie's mutual gamer and my coworker Joel have all played it and just, yeah. So I think with that leading the charge, we do need to look again at the subject that we did previously. So, yes.
Right. So, what I'm going to do here is that, you know, is following our normal topical method of looking at things. We're going to define a few terms so that, you know what we mean when we talk about them. And then we're going to go through a number of topics having to do with computer RPGs and tabletop RPGs. And we're going to talk about the pros and the cons of each of them, not so much against each other, but how they might differ one to the other. So what we're saying is we're not trying to be critical here. You know, there are some things that computer RPGs do much better, and there's some things that tabletop RPGs continue to excel at. Okay, but a lot of the other things that we used to think was a real problem, okay, may no longer be true, and our listener can make that decision. So, first thing we're going to do is we're going to do, and of course this is funny because it's in every single tabletop RPG, they need to feel the need to define what an RPG is. So, I'm going to do that here, okay? So, for our other hosts, just so we're all on the same page, an RPG is a role-playing game, and a role-playing game is a game in which players assume the roles of characters in a fictional setting. Players take responsibility for acting out these roles within the narrative, either through literal acting or through a process of structured decision-making or character development. Actions taken within many games succeed or fail according to a formal set of rules and guidelines. That's a mouthful, huh?
Yes.
All right.
So, yes, but it also covers pretty much all the bases.
Right, yeah. Right.
Oh, yes.
Because, like I said, we have to do that, you know, if we're going to talk about... One of the big questions we always comes in is it is a computer game that basically, you know, is handled by a relatively limited AI, you know, ever going to be able to produce the same experience as you can have on a tabletop. So first we have to define what an RPG is. For our discussion, that's what an RPG is. Okay, so now, with that in mind, we're going to move to our second definition, which is agency. Agency is a term that's used more in psychology, and it refers to how much you can affect the world around you and in what ways. The ability to manipulate environment and create change. A child has almost no agency because they have no money, they can't drive, they can't hold a job unless they're truly exceptional, and they can't vote. Generally, they can't bring suit against another person, and they are not as strong as the average adult. So therefore, it's your ability to do things, okay, and how much agency you have in a, you know, in these various games is going to come into question, okay? Then there's another thing, which is very, you know, kind of unique to RPGs, which is class protection. The idea that every character should be unique from all other characters. This is usually enforced during character creation or party formation, where you may only have one of each type of profession. Race is rarely limited like this. You know, usually there's no problem about having an entire party full of elves or dwarves, you know. But when
the Hobbit.
Or hobbits.
Look at the Hobbit. Yeah. Right. A party of dwarves with one hobbit in it.
Yes. But even today, I know that if you go to Gen Con, the biggest gaming convention in North America, there's this one guy who every year runs this this adventure, which is all monks. And everybody always looks at that askance because why all monks? Why not a mix like you would expect? Okay, and of course the point is that they're trying to show how flexible and great monks are. But you know, so I'm just saying. But class protection is one of the reasons why most games, you know, have these kinds of guidelines to be able to identify. And if it isn't something that's hard built into the game like it would be in a computer game, in a tabletop role-playing game, a lot of times it's still a goal. It's still something that the GM or the other players are expecting because nobody wants two characters that are carbon copies of each other. They hate that.
Usually somebody will focus in one direction or the other, yeah.
Which by definition means they're no longer carbon copies, right?
Exactly.
Okay, yeah. So,
although I will say that in the coming up, I think it's the Friday game trial, we've got two or three characters that are all rogue adjacent.
Yeah, but they still
for you.
Reader's Digest this. With Pathfinder and archetypes, it makes it where you could have three or four rogues and they are still different enough because of the various archetypes.
Again, these are role-playing concepts that basically you expect to be in role-playing games, which is why I'm listening. That's why these definitions are here. Okay, we only have one more, so please stay with us. Okay, hit points. This is an elusive indicator of body integrity. Rarely well-defined, and so surprisingly easy to recover and improve. It's a classic holdover from tabletop RPGs. And as I will explain a little later, there are better systems than hit points. But so many games use them because they are, you know, a trope. You know, they are something that people have always expected them to be. Okay. But and so you will find them usually in most tabletop RPGs, all computer RPGs, because it's expected. Because as we say, we go through this, we will discuss at some point hit points again, and we'll talk about why they don't have to be that way. So, all right. So that's the four main points that I wanted to say defines RPGs, you know, and as versed to, let's say, a space sim or, you know, a game that's purely action. Okay, you know, no one really, you know, when you're playing a racing game. Okay, you know, no one cares about how many hit points you have, all right? You know, but even there, you know, the amount of agency you have can make a big difference as far as your enjoyment of the game, You know, and of course, in a racing sim, unless you're playing Need for Speed Black, you know, where there are literally characters in there, you know, you usually don't care about who's driving the car. You just care about what the car can do. So, you know, that's why it's not an RPG, because it doesn't have, you know, these four things. Okay, so let's move on to our topics. All right. The first thing is, you know, is design. And that's, you know, how are these games designed? Okay, and what goes into the design of these games as far as, you know, just the general world in which they are designed. Okay, and by that I mean, you know, the business structure kind of thing. So the first thing is, on computer RPGs, as a pro, there's millions of dollars being spent on these, which fuels artists to produce massive amounts of art. You know, there are writers writing levels and dialogue and all kinds of, and then of course there's the designers whose job it is to take these various pieces and turn it into a story. Okay, you know, bring it all together to give it an aesthetic. Okay, so, you know, a game like Fallout looks completely different than, as you mentioned, Baldur's Gate 3. Okay. Yes. Even though there are similarities between them, okay, but that's, you know, and the latest games are all taking millions and millions of dollars, okay, and they're, and that's a good thing in the sense that you have all this money, so therefore you can do all these things, okay, because making a computer game, RPG, is hard, okay, and we'll get to why that is.
And that's just on the game design side of things, you know. Yeah. There's also going to be all your code monkeys and what have you, just making it physically work within the digital existence.
Right. Well, I should probably add, you know, that we're programmers instead of just designers. When I said designers, I actually was meaning that, but programmers.
Well, yeah.
So there's no question as to what I'm talking about.
It's the invisible part of the game, because with the designers, yeah, that's absolutely going to be your, you know, the ones who set the stage and the story and so on and so forth. Code monkeys are code monkeys. And I love them dearly. I know several.
Oh, I guarantee you that there are a lot of really weird things that go on in games, you know, that,
oh, absolutely.
That the code monkeys, you know, are the reason they are the way they are.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's because of the limitations of the environment, you know, the computing environment in which they're operating, okay? Sometimes it's just because the code monkeys want to do things a certain way. Okay. So anyways, now the con of this is the fact is that because there is so much money involved, everything is pretty much crystallized and flexible by the time the game is launched, because it's really easy to make changes at the beginning of a development cycle in any program.
Yeah.
When you get to the end, it costs millions of dollars to make any change because everything ripples through. And not only that, but everything has to be tested again and again and again every time you make a change, you know, which is also true on tabletop, but not to this degree.
I'm not spending $1 million in salary every year playtesting my home RPG.
Right. I mean, no. You know, you had people New Vegas came out. Okay, and the very first character you run into is this doc who's sitting down there talking to you about yourself and basically allowing you to make choices to your character. Okay, but in some people's experience, as he was sitting there, his head rolled off his shoulders, wandered about the room, rolling, and then rolled back onto his shoulders, and he kept talking as if nothing had happened. This was a bug that was there on launch because somebody didn't catch it. Now, I guarantee you that has never unintentionally happened in a tabletop RPG.
I mean, I could see a figure's, like one of my miniatures' heads popping off, but not rolling all the way back. And not certainly, well, okay, if I was voicing that miniature, it might be talking the whole time as I'm scrambling to try and pick the head back up. But
yeah.
But that's a very unique case. I would say almost never.
Right. Well, anyways, you know, so I'm saying that's the con, one of the cons. Okay, one is the fact is that you know, decisions that were made early, you're forced to, you know, the designers and everybody else are forced to live with them. Okay. Or if they do decide to make a change, it means that, you know, it's going to take months and months and months, you know, for them to get to the point where they can pick up where they were. Okay. So because of the, you know, restrictive environment, because of the fact that so much money is involved and nobody wants to ever admit they made a mistake. Oh Lord, no. Okay. So, but sometimes these decisions could be made on high. And so that's the con of computers as far as the design environment is concerned. Okay. Now, if we move over to the tabletop side of it, the design is usually driven by what they want the players to experience, what the experience of play is. Okay. And it can vary a lot. If you know, do you want it to be hard hitting? Do you want it to be something where they very crunchy, where they have lots of bits to work with? Do you want it to be, you know, completely theater of the mind? Do you want it to be something that has, a battle board? I mean, you know, you have a lot of choices, and it's really easy to change from one to the other. You know, if you say halfway through, well, I want to throw this in, it's usually not that hard to do it. Okay. It's, you know, historically, of course, you know, what tabletop has gone away from is disparate systems all being cobbled together. And so, you know, just like the computer role-playing system usually is a very unified system, the tabletop has also become very unified instead of these disparate systems that, you know, we're now in a boating situation, so now we're going to use completely different rules. Okay. Instead, you know, they are relying upon the game master. Okay. And this is one of the big differences between the two, is the fact is that the computer RPGs is almost entirely reliant upon the rules and the AI that's been built into that particular system. Okay, there may be humans involved, but not in the running of the actual adventure. A GM is almost always, you know, an essential part of any tabletop or RPG, which provides an enormous amount of flexibility, but also provides that AI, a superior AI than you would find in, you know, a computer RPG, at least so far. Okay. Some people would say that ChatGPT can produce better flavor text than your average GM could bring up on the fly. You know, you might be like, well, what's in this room? And you end up describing it like a dozen other rooms you've done that were just similar, but you type the same thing into ChatGPT, you know, and say, and throw in a couple objects, and suddenly you have a water glistening on the walls, you got writing on the pottery, you've got all kinds of things that you may not have thought about doing, but ChatGPT was perfectly happy doing that because it's stealing, you know, all that stuff from a million other people's writings, which were, you know, about the various genre that you're engaged in. So, all right. The con of a tabletop RPG in the design area is the fact is that usually there is a severe lack of development money. Now, we all have heard of a couple of RPGs that basically raised $1 million in 15 minutes.
I believe it's John Wick's 7C.
No, but that was a good choice. I was actually thinking of Savage Rifts.
Oh, I should have known that.
Sean Fannin was involved in that. Yeah. And it literally got, you know, basically it was, they wanted to raise $1 million so they could all basically work on it full time, you know, and they did it like in 15 minutes. It was amazing. They raised a lot more than that.
I remember seeing Sean's victory dance when that happened because I was here home for lunch years ago.
Yeah.
And just, I come in and it's like within 20 minutes, I already hit the goal. No, I do believe it was John Wick 7C. I remember talking about this with Blix and Mike Capes on MythWits had Sean on, and he had me on as well because I knew about Rift. And he had mentioned that it was John Wick 7C. I mean, Sean made a lot of money, but because I remember as they asked this question, what would happen if you got $1 million? Out of this, and Sean just flat out said, "You'd never see me again." I'm like, "Wow!" So yeah, it just the crowdfunding, I think, is the generic term for things like yeah, it has really, I mean, not a lot of people in the industry do it, but when they do it big.
The point I was getting to is that there's a couple of great examples where they raised like $1 million. Okay. But most tabletop RPGs are lucky to pull in a couple, you know, in tens of thousands.
Yeah. I can think of one that I backed that, but I backed at the very minimum level of $1 just so I could, you know, get the updates on it, and it did not turn out well, and it made its goal. So there's usually not enough money to do what you want to do, and even then, if you don't know what to do with that money, with a computer game, there is so much money involved, people know what they're doing with that money.
Oh no, because it's the company covering the budget. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying, though. It's like when you don't have a lot of money, even then, you also have the risk of not knowing what to do with that money and how to use it correctly.
Right. Well, hold on to that thought, Jonathan, because that's coming up. Okay. Oh. So, the lack of development money limits the scope of the game. It also means that there may be lacking in supporting materials upon launch. So, remember all that art we were talking about? Artists are expensive, and getting art... And I can tell you that, you know, in the publishing that I've done, most of the money I spent was actually on paying the artists.
Yeah.
You know, at the time, a cover art, it was like $400. And I was like, you know, just buying the rights to a piece of art for the cover of a book or something, which is one of the reasons why a lot of RPGs were not in color. They were in black and white with line art.
Oh, yeah.
And things like that, because that was much cheaper than going full blow color and everything else. Now, of course, you know, with the more success of a lot of RPGs and with Dungeons & Dragons leading the way, you know, there's a lot of games now that are that. And one of the biggest reasons is because they publish to, a lot of them publish to PDF. And PDF, you know, the publishing costs, the actual physical cost of putting words on digital formats is a minuscule amount compared to actually putting it on paper.
It's almost like one-tenth the cost. It's like I could get a PDF for $5, but printing it, oh, it's like $45. Yeah, so it's...
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. Okay.
Real quick, also, there's something I notice now that people are doing in the tabletop industry to help their art costs. I have seen this, oh God, over the past 10 years now, stock art. And there are even PDFs of that stock art where just, yeah, you can get it and buy it as PDF and just plug and play if you want to make something. Change the colors. It's all black and white. Change the coloring a little bit, you're good to go. It's all, you know, like pod safe music, you know, you can use it. There's no penalty. Yeah.
Yeah. There's stock art you have to pay for, and then there's stock art that's public domain. Both know a number of publishers that went that route, but they've been doing that since, you know, I started doing this kind of stuff in the 90s. So I'm sure they did it even before that. And then you had people like the Forgotten Futures, where everything was like supposed to be taking place in the 1800s. And so basically go down to your local library and, you know, take a picture or run it through the the scanner or something like that, and just take it home with you, which may have been a violation of, but probably not, because a lot of these books that we're talking about were published in the 1800s and they're out of
the pictures would be public domain anyways. Yeah.
So Jonathan, since you wanted to talk about this, let's move on to, in the case of a computer RPG, usually the loss of lead personnel is rarely catastrophic. Can you talk about that?
Oh yeah, in a computer RPG?
Yeah.
Yeah, if your like creative director leaves, or lead designer, or if you're Hideo Kojima and you're call yourself the director, yeah, if you leave the company, the game can still be made, because usually unless you left it like the very very start of the process, again, because there's so much money involved and so much redundancy.
There's so many people.
Yeah, there's so much going on and so many hands in the pie that even if it's the guiding light leaves the project or the company, the project can still be completed. It, It might lose a little luster by the end, but they can still work, get out a product.
Yeah, in some cases, a product can actually change companies.
Actually, I'm waiting on one now because I pre-ordered for our anniversary. I pre-ordered Vampire the Bloodlines 2. And the original designers, you know, got bought out by Paradox, and then they got shut down, and now Paradox is handing it over to another company. So
the problem, again, talking about when you have so much money, it's extremely reactive to the market instead of being led by a vision. So you end up with a lot of sameness between games. You know, this is also somewhat limited by the engines they use. It's also limited by people's understanding of what they can do. You know, so generally speaking, if you get one game that's successful, then all of a sudden you'll have a dozen other games that are similar. You know, sometimes they're outright stolen, but, you know, they're similar. You know, we all know about Diablo clones, right?
Oh, right. Gosh, yes. I would say this definitely applies in the AAA gaming market, but you do tend to see a little bit more in the indie scene. The problem with the indie scene is that it's harder to find those indie games that are made more out of passion than out of monetary gain.
Yeah.
Because, again, they have no money. They can't advertise.
You know, in this particular case, you know, in this discussion, we're not trying to set up any kind of straw man. Okay, we're not saying, you know, really poor computer game compared to, you know, AAA tabletop RPG. Okay, we're really trying to talk about the best versus the best. Okay, and the problems they still might run into. Okay, because that's how we can say how do they compare to each other. Because you can always find a straw man, you know, in anything, you know. Just like lots of computer games have run out of money and never get produced, there's been lots of Kickstarters for tabletop that didn't get their money. And so it was never produced, even though they've even did videos and all kinds of stuff. So we're trying to keep this on, you know, keep it on the high road, so to speak.
Keep it as the best examples of both.
So because it's reactive to the market, computer games, instead of leading, there's a sense of sameness between games. There's a lot of similar tactics, similar mechanics, similar things, or at least that's how it appears to the user. It may, and behind the scenes, you know, with the computer programming, there may be some revolutionary type things going on, but the experience of the players is usually pretty similar, which allows them to leverage, you know, happiness into another game. Hey, you like that game? Try this game. It's similar, right? You know. Now, when you go into the tabletop RPGs, you have a much more avant-garde nature, as you talked about, Jonathan, okay? I mean, they prefer to include unique and creative mechanics, if they can, if they've thought them up, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so you've got, you know, games that, you know, like Aces and Eights that, you know, use... that actually uses a deck of cards for the combat and initiative resolutions. Okay, you've got dice within dice, you know, in things like Quag. You know, you've got, well, I mean, just the weirdness where you've got, you know, D20 games, you've got D100 games, and you've got games where when you want to show an improvement, instead of giving them a higher number, you give them a bigger die, like Savage Worlds.
Yeah.
You see a lot more of these kinds of things. And then, of course, you have things that are completely narrative and other types of things. And, of course, we have games that are completely narrative on the computer. A lot of the light novel games are completely narrative, and there's no dice rolling involved. And it really comes down to you choosing... You choose a decision, and that brings you through the story a different path, and it may end up with a bad ending by using certain decisions. You know, that's part of that.
So basically, choose your own adventure.
It is a choose your own adventure. Yeah, with very pretty pictures. And sometimes they change that up. For example, I was playing a game on my phone that was just very much like a light novel, where you were a member of a crew on a starship, and there's a lot of talkie-talkie between the player, you know, the various characters, and things like that. And then something would happen, like pirates appear. And then what happens then is that they throw you in to a shooter sub-game, mini-game, all right, where you're trying to shoot the opponents, and if you succeed, okay, then you go along a path which is better for your characters. You know, the ship has less damage, you're going to be able to spend more time at the next port doing certain things instead of trying to fix the ship, you know. If you fail, then ultimately the game could end, but usually what happens is you manage to escape, but with a lot of damage and complications have now been added, you know, to the story. So they use this mini game to drive some of the dials in the computer game. So and this one of the things that's really great about computer games is that they can have all these, add these additional levels of complexity, where in a tabletop RPG usually that's too much for that very flexible but still only single brained AI that is the game master. So this is one of the reasons why early RPGs were very much, you know, it wasn't find the path like in a book, but you literally were expected to go from room to room to room to room to room until you finally got to the boss.
Yeah, the only branching choice is which path through the rooms.
Right. Yeah.
But they were all going to lead you
to
the same
place.
Yeah,
you were expected to pretty much end up in the same place, you know. So.
Okay. Wait, computer games that have games within games.
Called mini games, yes.
And forgive my wording here. I mean, it's nothing pod unsafe. Why is Final Fantasy punching me in the face with that example? Just, oh, you're doing this, and now you're in a chocobo race, and now you're, that's, the, yeah, as soon as you said that, that was just, yeah, okay, all right, yeah.
But then, you know, there's other mini games which I really liked. For example, in Bioshock, the first game, when you had to pick locks, what they would do is that they'd throw up this screen where they had this fluid, this white fluid that was going through pipes, these clear pipes, and you had to grab from a toolkit all these different pieces of pipe to send it to the right location so it could get out. If it did, that meant you picked the lock.
Oh, God.
And
I remember that. I played Bioshock. Carrie, you know of Aegis Consulting, right? You remember that?
Yep.
Okay, they had a Halloween party and they had Bioshock up on a wall. I remember doing that. Oh, God, it was like 15 years ago. Oh, geez. Yeah, but I do remember that. Yeah.
I thought that was a great mini game.
Oh, yeah, that was
tremendously stressful.
Yeah.
So stressful because, of course.
Oh, yeah.
The place you had to take the fluid out would vary on the screen. Sometimes it'd be easy to get to, sometimes it was practically right next to the beginning part so that. If you weren't paying attention, bam, you already failed. It was like, you know, because they would have these place, other things like bombs, you know, sitting out there that you'd, if you ran into it, that it exploded and you failed to do it. You know, I myself, frankly, that never happened to me because as soon as I knew I was going to do a lock picking thing like that, I always saved the game. So I would save and restore as many times as was necessary to get to success.
Save scumming.
Successfully unlock that door. So
I mean, it's not unlike the save every 30 seconds when you're writing something in, you know, in Word or other word processing program. It's that terror of, please don't let me lose this. I put too much work into it.
Well, we will talking about saving later. Okay. So anyways, there are really no cons to this thing, other than the sense that if you do lose those lead personnel in a tabletop RPG, yeah, usually the project's dead.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not even so much the lead personnel. You lose enough of your personnel, the game's dead.
Okay, so let's move on to, as you were talking about, Jonathan, to the business process. Okay, so what do we say about as an advantage to computer RPGs?
That much money means there are people who know how to spend that money to get the most bang for their buck.
Yeah. You have people that are actually business majors. You know, they actually have run businesses before and run major projects before. So, and you know, and you hire those people at the beginning of the project to make sure everything's done right.
Yeah, you've got your project managers who know how to set product timelines or, you know, project deadlines and all that kind of stuff. So we can say, all right, if we want this game out by this date, we need to have this aspect of the game finished by this date so we can start testing it and using it for this part on this date and this part. And you know, I'm getting almost overwhelmed thinking about all the things that go into making a computer game, because you have project deadlines, you have human resources and hiring, you know, specialists.
Yeah.
Then you have the marketing and.
Yeah, the marketing is important.
Oh God, it's so important.
you got to get the buzz started at a certain time, and then bring out, you know, your demos and all those other things like that. So yeah, you need people that are actually because there's so much money involved, okay, and you expect the game to be adopted by a large number of people, otherwise you wouldn't even do it. You're gonna hire somebody for big bucks that actually has some legs on how to do this sort of thing. That's how it is now.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So Jonathan, what's the con to the business process in a computer RPG?
Well, because there is so much money, everything needs to be focused on making money or making sure that when the product is released, it's going to make that money. So the ability to go in a more creative or experimental direction is severely squashed. And like what we mentioned before, that you see a lot of, you know, repeating existing mechanics and settings and things that have worked before because those have made money before. So you're not going to usually step too far into like new creative realms.
It's the whole, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Yeah,
because we know this makes money. How do we know that your idea is going to make us money? And you can see it, and usually, you know, some studios are learning that a little bit of experimentation is a good thing, because that's what catches people's attention, is when something new and interesting shows up on the scene. But usually they're not going to go too experimental. They might experiment with one new mechanic or one new story element or something like that, but they're not going to go whole hog and try and completely recreate the cart, so to speak.
This whole thing about real quick, and Jonathan, you'd mentioned that about these people that are driven to make money. That is their main thing. We got to make sure we're getting our money out of this. I have noticed this in my discussions in video games with, I will call them, the youngins at work. You have these people who all they know is the business. They know screw all about how to do the coding and how to go about getting this result. And so you have the creative versus the business. And it's the old phrase, one hand doesn't know what the other hand's doing. Because they can't see each other's. They're not pan-deterministic. That's the word I'm looking for.
They also really don't understand what each other does.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Not really,
The bean counter has no idea how to do code, and the code monkey has no idea, you know, okay, we need to do it in this budget. Well, I want to do this grand extravagant thing. You need three times the amount of money to do that, and we don't have it.
Yeah.
You get this much money. Yeah.
And which is why I'd say that those studios that have like multidisciplinary talents, you know, people who are good designers and marketers, you know, benefit, because they can see both sides of the coin and say, all right, yes, I get what you're saying about this marketing blitz, but it's not going to reflect well when the game comes out and we don't have these features you're implying we have. So no, don't do that.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. The thing is, I also don't want to get us into the trap of implying that trying to make money is a bad thing.
No.
If the studio doesn't make money, the studio closes.
So yeah.
when you're talking about computer games, I don't want us to get into the idea that, you know, having all, you know, having a look towards making money is a bad thing. It just, it is a challenge.
They need to balance it.
Yeah, it is a challenge.
Creativity, yeah.
And it's not just at the top either, because if you're a designer or you're a programmer or whatever, you know, in a computer game studio, and your game fails, okay, the next time you want to get the next job, or, you know, assuming, of course, that, you know, if it fails badly and you no longer have a company to work at, but the they're looking at you saying you were on a failed project. It's just like, it's just like theater. It's just like movies. Okay. You're only as good as your last game. You're only as good as your last, you know, whatever. And so a lot of these people will, you know, they will allow themselves to be abused in order for the project they're on to succeed, so they can stand up there and say, we did this great thing. It succeeded. Hot, you know, we are awesome.
I was part of this great team that made this great game.
Either then ask for more money, or, you know, or go to another company, or even start your own company with backers willing to back you because you succeeded. There's a lot of abuse that happens inside of these computer games because of this whole financial thing, you know, and a lot of game companies have basically said, you know, the crunch isn't as bad as it used to be, but instead the environment itself is toxic. And so therefore you get people dropping out of some of these companies, very creative people, you know. And of course, you know, when someone goes and says, well, we have to cut these features because, you know, we don't have the time, mostly it's the time to get them implemented before our drop dead publish date. The people who are creative are like pulling their hair out, saying that's the whole reason the game exists. You know, or it's not just your cow. Isn't just your holy cow that you can't stand to be gored. Okay, it's the fact is that, you know, a lot of these are very important to the game itself, you know, and so when they do these kinds of things, what happens more often than not these days is it's released in a partially tested or partially complete state, what we refer to as a beta, and they say, yeah we'll fix
early
it.
Access
early access, or we'll fix it after it's published, and they make the users, the people who are playing the game, They're testers.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
They release it at a slight discount and get feedback the entire time, and there's at least a good half of your testing budget covered.
You know, and they all say the same thing, which is that we don't want to do it that way. You know, for some reason or another, we ran into an issue, and if we hadn't done what we'd done, we never would have been published. Okay, or we would have all been fired. Or some of us would have been fired who didn't want to be fired, and so they basically, you know, did what was necessary in order to get the game out the door.
Well, also, we can use a term which we mentioned about 45 minutes ago. The companies that do this, to them, they feel that they are giving their audience agency in making the game. Well, you can, you know, it's like, we're going to have this beta, and we know that the people we give this beta to, they're going to flood us with suggestions. It, you know, gives, you know, you got, and I'm sure you got the one guy, and I'm mimicking here, smoking a cigar. Okay, let's get the buyers involved in this. It'll make them feel like they're part of the show, you know. And so giving them agency, as we mentioned earlier. So
it's like Gilbert Gottfried suddenly joined us as a host.
Oh no, I know that too. Oh no, I have a friend who does Gilbert Gottfried's voice far better than I do. That's just my default cigar smoking executive. I use it for any time some guy in business needs to be mocked. Yeah. But no, I noticed that with these betas, and again, with all the youngins at work, Joe and everybody else playing these games, I'm getting the sense of, yeah, there's some executive going, hey, why don't we let the players in on this and do that? And they talked about early release and beta. As I said, they're getting free work. That's all they're doing, is they're getting stuff they should have done, and they're getting it for free from the people.
That is true. Like, But I
yeah,
also
you're right.
Say
oh my God.
That the public are the best testers.
Yeah, yeah. I was gonna
yeah.
say
oh no, I don't.
It's also yeah. You know, if you have, you know, your company, whatever it is, Bethesda or one of the other big names, Capcom, whoever, they can only hire so many people to be their playtesters. But if you release it semi out into the wild, like into a controlled wild, you know, like a safari, then if you have 1,000 people outside of the company, random people off the street, a random sampling, essentially beta testing for you, it's a better sample size scientifically and statistically than the people you've hired for your company based on criteria that you set up. It's like, yeah. if you throw me certain types of games, I will go, eh, not my thing, and throw it back. Whereas other types of games, like sandbox style games, like Monster Hunter World and Baldur's Gate, things like that. Oh yes, please, more of that. And you know, hey, bring it over. So,
oh no, I'm not faulting the logic of doing that, but there's kind of a difference between, okay, this is going to be released to the public. Let's get the public their opinion so we can release a better game, as opposed to the companies, you know, with the bean counters cracking the whips and going, we don't want to have to pay for extra play testers. Do an early release and get the people who are going to buy this game anyways. Who knows? It's the whole million monkeys with a million typewriters thing. Yeah. They might come up with something we missed and we save money. So yeah, it's
yeah. Unfortunately, yeah. this they're the same companies.
It's the thing where both sides of this argument win. It's just a matter of which how you execute it, because you can execute like this early access model very, very wrong. Awesome. Usually, when that happens, it's obvious who was the brainchild behind it. Was it the bean counter saying, "Let's just get it out early and"? You know, we'll charge full price, but we'll call it early access so we can, you know, excuse the bugs. Or, you know, are we actually, you know, wanting to release it early, even though we have hardly done any development on it? We just want to get people's ideas before we even really have done much work on it ourselves. Both are bad ideas.
Right. And a lot of games, their computer, they are poorly optimized when they are published. And so that's one of the big things that the development team, if it's successful, does, is they go in and they find out ways to make the game better, more stable, faster, or whatever, you know, and you get that after. And they literally will say things like, yeah, you know, the money you're spending on this game is paying us to fix the game. Well, not to fix the game. They won't say that. But to improve the game, you know, and resolve any bugs that we, you know, that we had not already detected. Every time a new game comes out, it's a big game, a AAA game. You always have people that are screaming bloody murder that they've produced an inferior product, that they just spent the money for another few months of development and testing would have been 100% better, but we'll never know because they released it. It's really easy to go and throw those kind of stones at a really big, you know, company like that, you know, but it's a little harder to do it when you're talking about a small company, you know, and most tabletop RPGs are small companies, okay? And because of that,
yeah,
they suffer the other side of it, which is the fact is that all those experts, all those top of the line, whatever, you know, a lot of times, even though they might have top of the line game designers, they definitely don't have top of the line marketers. They don't have top of the line project managers. They don't have top of the line people doing, you know, social media. And after the game comes out, everyone's like, well, why didn't you, you know, why didn't you ask for more help, or why didn't you tell us about this, and why is, you know, why is this so bad? And they're all like, well, we spent our money developing a better game and didn't worry about that sort of thing, you know. But they all still have to get the game out by Christmas.
Yeah, I can think of one example of a, you know, tabletop role playing game company that does have the money for big marketing and all that. And we all know who it is. Wizards of the Coast.
I think you mean Hasbro, right?
But we've all seen that Hasbro, their executives can still mess up because they don't understand the market they're in now.
They have no idea about the tabletop market. No.
Yeah.
I just found out today the marketing lady running things, she resigned today.
Oh, dear.
Just it just came. Yeah.
For Wizards or Hasbro? Well,
Hasbro, which covers Hasbro Gaming and Wizards.
Yeah, you do understand that Wizards doesn't own Dungeons & Dragons anymore, right?
No, no, it's Hasbro. Yeah. It's
they just publish it.
Well, we know here in, 2024 and 2023, just the crap show will put that company has done recently with their decisions. And I can now see why.
They made what they considered to be a perfectly valid, business decision to protect their intellectual property and alienated their entire customers.
On more than one occasion, yes, with not just D&D, but with Magic, yeah. So, I mean,
on the plus side, it basically got a lot of other, companies that weren't quite as 800-pound gorilla, but pretty big companies just come out and say, well, we're going to release our, our game engine, our property under these kinds of licenses, which opens up for smaller companies to start using those kinds of things. And, it very much, opened up everything. I mean, it would not have become the powerhouse that it was, Dungeons and Dragons, without that open publishing license that it did.
Oh, in 2000, yeah, the OGL. Yeah, problem is now.
Oh, yeah.
This orc, I think they call it, and Paizo led that charge. Oh, God, Jeff and I lost count at like 1,600 other publishers, ranging from Paizo size to people literally doing it out of a home office. Like 1,600 different other game companies all went under this banner. So when you have the bad marketing decisions, because there are people that they think they're marketing, oh, because I'm going to get this result, and they end up alienating their audiences again and again.
Yeah, I mean, when you've got
what's the phrase? Competition brings out the best in a product, in a service, in a good.
When your primary product should have made you money are toys and standard like child board games.
Yeah.
And you get into a new industry, it's easy to think, well, we can just do the same thing we did with these and it'll work. And it's like,
no.
Different audience.
They kind of showed their behinds on all of this. And I can now see why this Catherine saw, I'm blanking on the last name, but I can see why she resigned, because just all of this.
Yeah. I mean, I looking at what they did with, like, say, just D&D, and then comparing it to, oh, who is it Milton Bradley that has Monopoly?
I think so.
And looking
either
at
that or they, Parker Brothers.
One of those two. And looking at how they treat Monopoly and all their Monopoly games, it's almost I can see the similarities. But that's the thing, is they aren't quite the same market. Granted, yes, both are played at a table. Both are games that you play at a table, but they're not quite the same. I can see where the mistakes were made, but that's
Chutes and Ladders are nothing like Dread.
yeah.
Okay, so Carrie, why don't you talk us a little bit about goal resolution and how the benefits that come from the computer RPGs.
The nice thing about computer RPGs, at least the more recent ones, is that things are really complex. Like, you have to go through. I mean, classic example, it's not a RPG, but classic example is the lever in Myst, where you spend weeks and days trying to figure out what that lever does, and you have to go through this step, then this step, then this step to make it work. Whereas all that information that's going on in the background about what needs to be done is hidden from the player. So that leads to a game that has that level of stress but good stress and realism and the ability to problem solve your way through things without being able to like pause everything and think about it really hard, depending on the game you're playing. So it's definitely one of the pros of computer RPGs, is that you simply can work out these problems that are multi-step and very complex. I would say a variation on that would be the games like Monster Hunter, where you have to do the grinding to get whatever it is you need to defeat the specific monster over here to lead to the next part of the plot line and so on and so forth, throughout the process of the game. So it's definitely a very satisfying process for that alone is complex problem solving.
Math.
Math. There is a lot of math.
Anything. Yeah. Anything that involves big or complicated math, a computer RPG can handle as, you know, within milliseconds.
Absolutely.
But not necessarily like complex math. A lot of times we're talking about a lot of different things, like, you know, you, if you have any kind of a mass combat situation, computers can handle that easily. People have a really hard time doing that in any kind of a reasonable period of time.
Four characters fighting a goblin in D&D is going to take you a lot longer than it will in Baldur's Gate 3.
Okay, fair enough.
Fair. I mean, there's also the classic example of the 50-minute walk takes 4 hours, and the 6-second battle, or excuse me, the opposite. The 4-hour walk takes 15 minutes, and the, you know, 15-minute battle takes 4 hours. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not even 15 minutes on average. It's more like 5 rounds.
And Jonathan, what are the cons of computer RPGs when having to do with goal resolution?
Basically, you can't do anything that the designers didn't already prepare for.
So you have to figure out what you can do. And that's what we were talking about, agency, right?
Yeah. Usually, the good games will tell you what you can do. The really great games will tell you most of what you can do and give you hints to some really surprising fun things you can do, but may not outright state it. But the bad games will just plop you down and just say, go, do. And not really give you any hints.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can honestly say that's one of the things I've discovered with Monster Hunter is that there's, you know, very specific things that you can learn exactly how to do, like how to, you know, do the forward, you know, attack with your weapon of choice, insect glaive, and, you know, basic mechanics like that. But there are so many things where it's just like, wait, can I do this thing? Can I actually go over there? Can I walk on that thing? Can I pick that up? And lo and behold, you can pick it up. And then something happens. It's really quite delightful when they do leave you a little bit of exploration time as opposed to railroading you through every point of the game.
Yeah, a lot of games, you know, especially like, you know, D&D-ish type RPGs, they'll have things like secret passageways, or they'll find, you know, you'll find something, a key that will lock a certain section. But, you know, you walk into the room, you know, you have to start clicking on every single thing in the room because you don't know what's going to react and what isn't going to react. The worst case scenario for that, you know, and again, we're talking about the good things, not the bad things, but, you know, everybody thought it was revolutionary at the time, and that was the original Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, good grief. I do remember that.
It had a syntax engine in it. So basically, it would parse the sentence that you gave it to do things. And the very first thing you had to do was put a babblefish in your ear so you could understand the Goldfrinchens, which we kind of might think were the bad guys. But anyways, and you had to learn that if you just did a simple phrase like go east, go west, whatever, that didn't really help you too much. But if you said something like, pick up my towel, and drop it, you know, in front of a hole and stand in front of the towel and then push the button, then a certain of actions would happen, and the babblefish, instead of just zipping across the room and into a hole and down a drain, which is what you've been frustrated up till now doing, suddenly would be stopped by your towel and you'd be able to catch it and shove it in your ear. So you had to learn. The sentences could be a lot more complex than you thought they could, because there was literally no hint at all in the instructions. You were supposed to figure this out. Okay.
I do actually remember that. I have to take that back. It's been a while, but yeah, I do remember that. Absolutely.
And Steven Jackson was, you know, should have been shot for the game he brought out called Hacker, where you boot up the game and you end up with a blinking cursor on the screen and that's it.
Oh, I remember that. Wow. Oh, my word. Oh, I just, I can press the memory.
And you're supposed to figure out how to hack. If you don't know anything about computers, about programming or anything like that, you're going to fail that game.
I just had a horrible flashback. Thank you.
We've come a long way from there.
Yes, we have.
This is Bruce Sheffer. saying there are a million worlds out there, so go explore them.
And this is Trav. There's a reason why it's called gaming. It's for having fun.
Gaming on the Frontier podcast is wholly owned by its hosts. It is released under the Creative Commons 3.0 license. No commercial reproduction and any use of any element of the podcast must be attributed to the Gaming on the Frontier podcast.
Hi, this is Trav from the Travcast. Listen to me Tuesday nights, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern on listen.dementiaradio.org/8027.